According to our next guest, we have a healthcare system that fails to acknowledge the life-altering consequences of trauma and the urgent need for outdated treatments to catch up to the latest brain science. In his new book, The Body Keeps the Score, Brain, Mind, and Body in the Healing of Trauma, psychiatrist Bessel van der Kolk, the world's preeminent clinician and researcher in the field of traumatic stress, looks to force trauma out of the shadows and says that we need to see it for what it is, America's biggest public health threat. Again, the name of the book is The Body Keeps the Score, and we welcome Dr. Bessel van der Kolk. Very nice to have you with us. Give us an idea of where we have come when it relates to this new science and brain science about what we know about trauma and why ultimately you believe we are treating it incorrectly.
For one thing, we have started to look at it, and the Centers for Disease Control and other organizations have done large epidemiological surveys. And we know that about 3 million kids per year in the U.S. are reported for abuse and neglect. More women get killed by their domestic partners than soldiers have been killed in wars. More children get killed by guns than by leukemia. So violence in our society and trauma is a gigantic issue. And indeed, the Center for Disease Control showed that it's eventually the largest public health issue, leading to chronic illnesses, incarceration, social problems, violence, lost work days, inability to work, etc., etc. The big change is, aside from knowing how frequent it is that we now know something about what it does to the brain, how it changes people's threat perception systems, their ability to concentrate, to focus, to pay attention, to engage with other people, to filter out irrelevant information, and how it affects learning and the ability to work, basically.
Let us talk a little bit about the long-term effects on the body that trauma has. You mentioned it a moment ago, but let us talk about some of the specific long-term effects.
The long-term effects is that people's brains get stuck in fight, flight, or freeze. So they're not really fully alive to engage in the present. They feel agitated, out of sorts, numbed out, not like themselves, not fully alive in the present. Makes it hard to get along with your coworkers, makes it hard to be in relationships, makes it hard to take care of your kids. And this is really because of alterations in the core survival areas of the brain that sort of gets stuck in a state of, I'm going to die and terrible things are going to happen to me. And in order to cure that, one has to go into these nether recesses of the brain. And one needs to actually make it possible for the body to feel safe again.
So you make the point in the book that these traumatic situations rewire our brains. They change our brain. So what is going on physiologically?
Physiologically, what goes on is that people keep secreting stress hormones. The brain areas involved in threat detection stay on high alert. The brain areas involved in sort of subtle discriminations and the sort of subtlety that you need to function well on day-to-day level get impaired, so it becomes very hard to focus on small details. And so you get stuck in this hyper-aroused threat state, or sometimes in a numbed-out defensive state. And you can see that on brain scans, on fMRIs, you can see it in quantitative EEGs, how the wiring of the brain changes, and the filtering system of the brain, a very important part of the brain, is you need to filter in what is relevant and filter out what's not relevant. And these filtering systems get damaged. So the stuff that is not really all that important becomes terribly important, and stuff that is important gets ignored.
I'm assuming it depends on the traumatic incident of what we are talking about. But in general, if there was to be an attack or an assault, At what point would we see it on a brain scan? What is the time frame? What is the window?
Oh, you could see it probably pretty rapidly in a brain scan. The question is whether people return back to normal. And there the issue of how well the environment deals with traumatized individuals becomes terribly important. And so if you get traumatized by your own caregivers or your own spouse, the chances that things will let up quickly and that everything will be okay is pretty slim, because these become secret issues that keep going on. If you have a car accident or you're assaulted by a stranger, it is quite easy to find help and for a supportive environment to bring you back to a state in which you can feel relatively safe. So indeed, the context in which the trauma occurs is terribly important.
You write about this in the book, and I'm interested in your explanation of the attachment research that you've done that shows childhood neglect is even more harmful to development than trauma. How so?
Yeah, well, it's not only me, it's actually a large number of researchers show this, is that our brain is wired to be interactive with other people. Our brain is an interactive organ that makes it possible for us to live in social settings, which is what we have brains for, basically. And if you get ignored, not seen, not synchronized with, not held, not comforted, then some very essential brain elements do not come online. And you learn to fend for yourself. And fending for yourself oftentimes has not very good consequences. You oftentimes tend to fend for yourself by ingesting drugs or alcohol to make those awful feelings go away. Many people who get neglected develop eating disorders. Many people who are neglected may cut themselves and do other harmful things to change the way we feel. So basically, the way that primates, human beings, are wired is that we're supposed to, when we get upset, to help each other to not be upset anymore. But if you're neglected, you lose that environment that's there for you when you're upset. And so the brain becomes rewired to try to take care of itself instead of relying to other people. And that succeeds to a certain degree, but the price for that is quite high in terms of pleasure, engagement, joy, feeling alive, feeling engaged, feeling connected with the world around you.
Your diagnosis is developmental trauma disorder.
No, that's not my diagnosis. We, the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, which is a national network funded by Congress, encompasses 150 centers around the country. We proposed to the American Psychiatric Association to have a new diagnosis that would encompass vital issues about childhood trauma and neglect, and that diagnosis is called developmental trauma disorder.
And that differs from what is often the current diagnosis of PTSD.
So PTSD is a diagnosis that my cohort put on the map 30 years ago in order to clarify what happens to people who get assaulted at one time as an adult. So a single traumatic incident changes people to some degree. If you're a kid and you live in an environment where your caregivers don't take care of yourself and become sources of stress, it has very much more complex impacts on the brain, on the mind, on development, on learning, that PTSD in no way begins to approach. And for those people, they need a much more complex and attentive type interventions to help their brains to become and their minds to become able to function and to feel alive right now.
Dr. Bessel van der Kolk's new book is The Body Keeps the Score: Brain, Mind, and Body in the Healing of Trauma. Let us talk about some of the treatments, and you write about this extensively in the book. How important is medication in this treatment?
Medications are somewhat helpful to take the edge off the worst of the hyperarousal and the sleep disorders. And the medications certainly have been a useful adjunct. The trouble is when medications take the place of treatment, it's a disaster because medications don't cure people. Medications make some of the symptoms less bad. So if medications become the only treatment, people basically get stuck in a very markedly decreased level of functioning without really getting healed from the trauma. But they do have a role, and per se, they're not bad things to give to people.
So you talk about the importance of building relationships and the social support and that network that you have in building relationships as part of the healing process.
Yeah, see, we are social creatures. So our brain is all about connections. It's all about getting along with people, communicating with people. And when you get traumatized, you get this. You become very disconnected from the world around you. You sort of live in your own misery and your own trauma, your own disconnected biology. And so being connected with other people is very, very, very important. But very many traumatized people are scared by other people and are ashamed of themselves. And so they have trouble making connections. But for people who try to help traumatized people, making those vital connections is absolutely central to the healing process.
So in that healing process, I mean, you're talking about a traumatic event, as you described earlier, as rewiring your brain. So what therapies do you have at our disposal of rewiring it back to the way that it should be or the best that it can be?
Well, the most concrete way is that actually we can rewire the brain with something called neurofeedback, where we can have people play computer games with their own brainwaves, and by setting the dials in a way that makes the brain more focused and more attentive and more functional, we can actually help to train the brain to become calmer and to be less frightened. So that's the most concrete way of doing it. That's a fairly not a mainstream technique. It's about 10,000 people in the U.S. who practice it, but it's not reimbursed by insurance companies. But that's the most concrete way in which you can do it. And my center actually is very involved in doing research and publishing research in the efficacy of that modality. But there are simpler ways. Depending on how complex the trauma is. If people have had a single trauma, a single car accident, a single assault, witnessing something terrible, EMDR, eye movement desensitization, is probably the most effective treatment. At least our study funded by the National Institute of Mental Health had better outcomes than just about anything that has been studied at this point. But that is best for relatively discrete single incident traumas. That is not what most people we see suffer from. Most people we see have been exposed to long ongoing threats. That's true for soldiers. It's also true for people in domestic violence situations, kids who are being abused. And it's not just bad memories, but they have lived in an environment where they feel constantly threatened, so it is not a single incident. And for those people, they need to be helped to get out of their alarm state. And to get out of your alarm state, you need to learn to calm down your arousal system in your brain. And there we have very much turned to its techniques that are not so much Northern European and American techniques, which is mainly talking and drugs, but in places like China, people do Qigong, Tai Chi. In India, people do yoga. In Africa, people do drumming. So other cultures have actually invented techniques that are very, very helpful to help people to decrease their arousal in their bodies and to feel more calm and more focused. In in our center, we have a very active yoga program. We have studied yoga, again, funded by the National Institute of Health, and found out that in our very chronic treatment-resistant population, yoga was more helpful than any medication that has ever been studied for PTSD. So learning to become get into your body and to be still in your body and to become quiet is a very important part of recovering from trauma. And we're only at the beginning of understanding of all the pathways through which something like a focused yoga, meditation, mindfulness-based practice can actually help people to get back into themselves, or as I like to call it, coming home to yourself, feeling yourself, and feeling safe with yourself. Then talking is very important. If you have been abused and you have been in a violent relationship, people oftentimes feel very ashamed of themselves. They feel that they cannot talk about it. They oftentimes cannot talk about it because most people don't want to hear stuff like that. And that's what you have a therapist for, to whom you can say what really happened and put it out there and allow yourself to know what you know. And much about the trauma is that it is so overwhelming and so horrible that you want to push it out of your mind. And that's very helpful as a survival technique. But sooner or later, you need to allow yourself to know what actually happened. And for that, very thoughtful, careful talking therapy is a very important part.
I was fascinated in the book that you recommend theater to traumatize patients.
Oh, yeah. Theater is absolutely one of my favorite treatments, particularly for our adolescent traumatized kids, because they get stuck in these roles of being a tough guy or a bully or a wimp or only good for sex or frightened all the time and helpless. And in theater, people can actually play roles where they can viscerally experience what it's like to be something other than what I like to call our organism, our whole body and mind have sort of assumed for ourselves. And so traumatized people say, I'm a veteran and I'm a tough guy, but I feel terrible all the time. For that person, it might be very helpful to play the role of a nurse in the play or to play the role of something else and to just feel what it feels like to assume another role than with you, but life has dealt to you at a certain moment. Also, theater is a wonderful way for people to connect with other people, to feel like a vital part of an organization. If you don't play your role well, the whole play falls apart, so it really helps people to feel very alive in the present while beginning to reorganize your relationship to your body.
You have a lot of ideas in the book and public policy ideas in the book, and I'm curious as to where your optimism lies, of where you think we're headed in a healthcare system that is thought by many to be broken in many phases and in many places, of where your optimism lies in helping especially the children that are impacted by trauma.
Great question, you know, because it's so funny. I live in this dual world, the dual world of mainstream medicine, which is broken and where people have these stupid diagnoses that get treated with drugs and nothing else and don't get treated because the drugs don't really do the trick. And then there's this other world, which is an amazing thing about the culture we live in, of people who are vitally connecting with kids who are doing amazing things in classrooms. I know theater directors. I know various school programs that we and other people are involved in, where kids are very what we know about trauma is being applied, and I see that all over the country. There's just this amazing groundswell of people who are not getting reimbursed by insurance, but who do amazing work for the kids because they actually learn what happens in the brain and they learn what science is teaching us and they're applying it. The sad thing is that the insurance companies in the mainstream is not very open to exploring these new things. But I hope that my book will be read by insurance companies and by policymakers and by the Veterans Administration, so they can actually begin to implement treatments that are based on what we have learned through science and not through our just take a drug and make it go away type culture that we live in.
Because it seems like when you talk to your colleagues, they agree with you. It's getting the policymakers to change their mind.
Well, some of my colleagues do. My colleagues who work with kids, by and large, are extremely open because they are up against the wall. I mean, we are having millions of kids in this country who, if it goes on the way it is, will not be able to be contributing members of society. So people who work in residential treatment programs, who work with foster kids, tend to be very, very open to try everything they can to help these kids to become mature and functioning adults. And again, this is not funded usually by mainstream funding sources, but a lot of private philanthropies and the Robert W. Johnson Foundation and other people are interested in helping people who work with all these kids to do that, but we need a lot more support for that. And so there's these two worlds, the world of the mainstream, but that gets all the money, and that's all the very large world of people who are very active and hardworking on helping kids and traumatized adults to function and have a life for themselves.
The name of the book is The Body Keeps the Score, Brain, Mind, and Body in the Healing of Trauma. The book is published by Viking. Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, thank you very much for spending time with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Many thanks.
Privilege. Okay, bye-bye.
Again, the name of the book is The Body Keeps the Score. It's published by Viking. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.